writing, I'm going to talk about the psychology of adult writing. That's, there's relatively little research about particularly adult writers with dyslexia, directly on that, but at the end I will talk a bit about some of the early research we've done on that. And I'll introduce you to Sophie Hall, who's my PhD student, who's doing research, currently doing a PhD in this area. She's carrying out a survey of undergraduates, so adult writers, and I've put the link there, so any help you can give us with posting that to sites you know, or any links you can give to those students would be absolutely fabulous. But that's on those slides, which you can download later on, and you should have a little handout of that. Okay, so the plan for today, can you read that all right from the back? It's actually a question, hoping for the answer, yes. Because if you say no, I'll say sorry. So I'm going to talk a bit about two contrasting approaches to the psychology of writing, one of which is the kind of, I would say, the dominant traditional approach, treats writing as problem solving, and one of which is, I've been developing with my colleagues, which is a dual process approach, and I'll tell you about that. One implication of that contrast is a traditional approach tends to support a traditional outlining approach to carrying a writer, which is probably the dominant way. And we suggest that that could be complicated with what I'll describe as a reverse outlining strategy, and I'll give you some evidence to support that might be useful. Then I'll give you an overview of some of the research we've been doing using keystrokes into the dual process model, and then I'll go into some preliminary research we've been doing on writing with dyslexia and what effects that might have. And I'd be very interested to hear from your experiences, things that you think might conflict with what I've been saying, or extra information, or ask about it. So at the end, I'll hope to do things fast enough so we've got plenty of time for discussion. Because research on writing and how people manage when they have to deal with dyslexia at the same time is very much in its infancy. So we're really interested to hear what you have to say about. Sophie's been doing some interviews with students trying to write, and that gives us all sorts of interesting insights. So we'll be really interested to hear what you have to say. So that's the where to next, and we hope you'll help on board. Okay, so I'll give you a quick summary of the writing as problem solving. That originated about 30 years ago, and was based on writers thinking aloud while they wrote, thinking, saying everything they thought. You might think writing's hard enough without having to do that, but people manage it. And it treats writing as a matter of taking knowledge stored in your long-term memory, retrieving that, and then holding it in your working memory and manipulating it as you think about what you want to say next, how to organise things. And it's very much focusing on the thinking behind the text, what goals you direct your writing to, which is an important part of instruction, is that people should understand what you should be trying to do in writing, and that's one of the main areas this focuses on. It treats the actual process of writing stuff out as something that potentially gets in the way of that. Okay? Really, you want to reduce that as much as possible and be able to focus on what am I trying to do, how do I need to convey an effective message to other people. The main contrast here is between knowledge telling, which tends to be younger writers or less expert writers, and a knowledge transforming approach to writing. And the contrast between that is knowledge telling, essentially, typically with young children, is when writers just write down things as soon as they come to mind. Write it down, and actually there's very little difference to what you think and what you actually eventually write. And if you look at young children's plans for writing, they tend to be very much, you ask them to make a plan and then ask them to write the text, they're pretty much the same thing. And so the idea is that you just dump your knowledge on paper. Knowledge transforming, which is characteristic of more expert writers, is when you mediate those black holes, you think about what you're trying to do, you evaluate potential ideas, and there's a lot more reflection both before you write and during writing and after writing. And so essentially that's the major thing. And as I said before, with the emphasis on thinking, the difference between this is the goals to which your thinking is directed, and a strong emphasis on instruction is thinking about the purposes of writing and about what any bit that you're currently writing, how that fits into the overall strategy you have for a piece of text. Related to that is the problem of managing cognitive load. That is the worst thing about writing, you've got so many different things to do. You have to formulate your thoughts in language, put those in a written form, but at the same time you've got to think about what your goals are, etc. And research on that suggested that the best strategy, or an effective strategy for doing that, is to try and separate out these separate processes into different stages. And particularly, outlining before you write, according to this, is a crucial aspect where you minimise the amount you have to write anything down, just minimal notes, jotting down to referring to the idea. And you can focus on, now if I do that first, where that going to go, I need to set this up, do this, and working out the overall strategy first is very effective. And then, when you actually write the text, you can focus on how am I going to express this, and all the details of that. And this, that's been established for a long time. It's good. Is this a smart one? I was worried I'm going to touch things. And there's research by Kellogg which has established that that is effective compared to other strategies. I'll call that to question later on, but that fits with this general controversy. And one question is about this is that according to the theory, even when you're trying to write an individual sentence, the same kind of reflection, thinking about what you're doing, is suggested that this goes all the way down. So that actually producing words and the sentences that you want to express your ideas is similarly, according to this, an expert will be much more reflective about that. They'll think about each word, choose how they do that, and write that down, and then proceed on to the next. And I put a question mark about that, because that hasn't really been studied very much. So writing research has tended to focus mostly on the thinking behind the text, and not very much on the fine-grained detail of how people produce content and formulate the content. Okay, so that's that overall view of text, the traditional thing. Focus on the goals of really making writing being goal-directed and having strategies to manage the load of all that, which is classically an outcome. And a lot of the focus of instruction is trying to clarify what the purposes and underlying functions are of different parts of the text. Okay, so I'll now talk a bit about and present some evidence about the dual process model, because that accepts that part of the aspect of writing. That's one part. But it claims it hasn't, it's got a false idea of how you produce text. I put a reference there in the link, and there's a reference at the end, so there's a paper about this you can read in detail, but I'll go through it. So that suggests, yes, part of the knowledge transforming process, the problem solving, is this deliberate thinking process. And that's aimed at you trying to construct in your head an overall mental model of what the text is and what you want to do to your audience. And you want that to be a coherent sort of object in memory. And that corresponds to knowledge transforming. So it accepts that aspect. But says that this has neglected the fact that text production, when you actually produce sentences, when I'm speaking now, is not something I'm consciously thinking beforehand, I want to say this, and then translating. But it's something where I'm constituting what I think as I speak it, and as a relatively spontaneous process. The other aspect of the dual process model is it claims text production is not more deliberate problem solving, rather it's a different kind of process which we is controlled by our implicit understanding, I'll say a little bit about that, of how, which we built up over time, and which we formulate, and then once we formulate it, we say, okay, what do I need to say next, given I've said that? And so spontaneously, the content of what we want to say emerges. The problem with that is we can't control it ahead of time. So I mean, it conflicts with the need to be strategically in control and say, I need to do this, and do that, and do this. Then when you try and actually say it, it comes out, and you're following the path of it, and reclaim. This helps develop your understanding. That's a positive thing. But in doing that, you disrupt the text. And the conflict that writers have to manage is this conflict between finding out what they want to say and groping towards that, which is something that happens as you formulate thought in language, but at the same time, trying to produce a good text. And those two things are intrinsically conflicting. And that's a different conflict between having to think of too many things at the same time. It's a conflict between kind of what you don't know yet, your own personal view of what it is you want to write, and discovering that as you write, and at the same time, we need to present that to someone else. And so, as we'll see, we suggest that an important part of writing is allowing yourself to do this, and then revising and imposing organisation afterwards. We characterise that as reverse outlining. So it's saying you need to do the two things, but that actually it claims that making an outline beforehand can suppress this need to develop your own thought. And particularly with more expert writers, can suppress their kind of personal distinctive view on that. And we'll report on some evidence with undergraduate writers suggesting that reverse outlining may be a better way of helping them build their voice and their own original point of view on the topic. Okay, I think that's a good one. Okay, this is a little bit more about the, I hope that's visible about, just about how this is represented. This is built on complementary learning systems theory, which claims there are two different forms of both learning and sort of knowledge representation in the brain. So the first of these is represented in the hippocampus and pointed to that arrow, the schematic diagram. And it represents a kind of episodic subject memory of individual ideas. You can think of, if it, I think about a topic, I'm trying to remember, I think, oh, it's that idea, it's this idea, etc. And we suggest that that is the basis for the knowledge transforming process, writing as problem solving, in which they retrieve individual ideas from memory. And knowledge telling is when you just write it out with no further ado. Okay, you just write down stuff you've got in memory. And there's no sort of discovery or anything, it's just a knowledge dump. In order to transform those, you need to manipulate those in your working memory, and that means there's a cognitive load that's complex, you want to remove it from having to actually translate it to text and so forth. That's the knowledge transforming. So we claim that the knowledge, the problem solving operates on those kinds of representations, and there's a separate place in the brain where essentially that's more biased when you can do that. In the neocortex surrounding those, these two are interlinked systems, and actually the representations in the neocortex are based on repeated presentations of things through episodic memory, and that's extracts out the semantic structure of the environment, and it consists of an implicit representation of the knowledge we know about that, and that's stored in the connections between units. What that means in effect is that we can't just directly retrieve it, but we have to use that structure we've done to synthesize our knowledge, and it's only once that's produced that we can see what it is we know. And that means that the organisation of those ideas comes out one idea at a time, and the overall representation of what it is that you think is something that you build up step as you synthesise the first thing and then respond, oh, in the light of that, the next thing, and so on. And that the overall idea that you have is something that emerges through interaction with you producing it and then the responding to that. So this is kind of ideas emerging in the course of writing. This is taking existing ideas and manipulating those and thinking how you want to present those. And those two things come together, and we have to manage those during writing. And the conflict is this often may go in different directions to what, when you actually write it the other way. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about some evidence about how we've tried to study that, and evidence that supports quite a lot of the features of the dual process. So this involved asking people, undergraduates, to either make an outline before writing for 10 minutes, or the same amount of time, they were allowed to think about the topic, etc., but they had to just write a single sentence. Okay? They weren't allowed to specify the order of what they were going to write in the text. Okay? So that was the manipulation of those kind of things. We then recorded their keystrokes. So every keystroke that they do unobtrusively sits behind. It is a bit, you are conscious it's there. Whenever I do this, I think, every keystroke, they're sort of following. And occasionally when we have our writers do this over a long period of time, they will make little comments to you and then delete it because they know that you'll be able to see this because you can see the recording, but the text it won't show. And so people say, this is great, people don't know it's there. Actually, people do know it's there. So mine's slightly portable. So we've, in some previous research, we've used principal components analysis to identify two processes underlying those. One is how spontaneous the production of individual sentences is. And that dimensions a variety of measures you can see in the keystrokes consists of how long they pause before a sentence. Okay. And so in controlled sentence production, people pause for a relatively longer time. Whereas in spontaneous, it's a relatively brief pause. Okay. But they also, in controlled sentence production, consists of a long pause and then a clean sentence produced. So it's like they're loading up everything to the first part and then producing something pretty cleanly. Then the next sentence, pause, so forth. It's quite deliberate. Spontaneous, short pauses, is type of it, this was keystrokes rather than handwriting. People have done equivalent things with handwriting, but I won't talk about that one. So spontaneous consists of brief pauses, sort of correcting stuff as you go along, and so forth, so it's messy. Okay? So that's a clear, reliable dimension we could identify from the keystrokes. And it's separate also from how linearly, so that's about how they produce individual sentences, that go along. The global revision measure looks at how, taking each sentence, is how linearly they are produced. So if they're very linear, the person writes the first sentence, second sentence, third sentence, and gets to the end, and they're done. Okay, no changes. If they're non-linear or they revise a lot, then they might write a few sentences, go back two or three, insert two sentences, go back to the front, and so forth, and that involves a lot of global revision. So we call that the global revision scale, and it varies between nothing, complete, pure, just producing out. You can think of that as like a knowledge term. It's like someone sits down, writes it all out, stop, it's done. Okay. Whereas knowledge transforming would be where they write a bit, revise it, write a bit, and so forth. And that's above the sentence level. The other one refers to how they produce individual sentences, and it's a contrast between deliberate versus relatively spontaneous. Okay, so we asked them to write in these two different ways. There's about 80 people, so about 35 people in each condition, different people in each condition. We measured their keystrokes, looking for these two different aspects, and then we asked, before they wrote, we asked to say how much they felt they knew about the topic, which in my they were writing about this was a self-chosen topic. My collaborator Vila Bayan, was in Groningen. She asked the students what they would like to write about, what was their top topic, and it was about social media, internet, and was it a good and bad thing? So we gave them that topic to write about. So before they wrote their essay and before they made their plans, is that right? Yes. We asked them to rate how much they felt they knew about that topic. And then again, after they wrote about the topic, we asked them to rate again how much they felt they knew about it now. And sometimes that stayed the same, sometimes it went up, and sometimes occasionally went down. So that was our measure of discovery. And we wanted to see how the different process of writing, how does the way you plan beforehand, how does that influence the extent to which you develop your understanding through writing, or not. And the other thing was we asked two judges to rate the quality of the text they produced. Okay, so that's to give us an idea of how well have you managed to do this. They were writing a short article about pros and cons of social media called the student newspaper was the task they were set. So the judges were judging how good is this as an article form. Is everyone kind of clear about it? So, first thing we looked at was how does this relate to text quality? According to the problem-solving model, then we'd expect people who just knowledge tell that it's not very good quality, the more they do change the structure of it as it goes on, that what you'd expect would be more knowledge transforming, and according to the problem-solving model, that should help you. So it's better if you're really thinking about how to put this together, revising the structure as you go along, and so forth. And we found that. So the first one was, the more people revise and modify the structure, so the less they just wrote it out one sentence after the other, the more better quality. And that was regardless of the kind of planning they'd done ahead of time. And in fact, when you wrote, and you were able to sum this up to start with, you were more likely actually to have to do that because you weren't able to work it out before. And secondly, that the more deliberate and controlled your sentence production, so the long pauses, clean production, etc., the better the quality. And both of those kind of fit with the problem-solving model. You need to adjust what you're saying to external goals, though you can't just write it out, you have to put some revision in, and you need to control and deliberately produce sentences. And importantly, a more spontaneous sentence production, the opposite of control sentence production, was negatively related to quality. Okay? So that's kind of fits with the dual process, although they're saying, actually, this isn't something good for quality. Second thing was the other dimension, which is how much the writer themselves feel I'm no more and I'm developing my understanding of what the text's about. According to the problem-solving model, that should be the same thing. Okay? Because it just depends on how much you adapt it to. So it should be the same thing as producing quality. Okay? According to the dual process model, this is a conflicting process. And what we found here was there are two separate things to you developing your understanding. One is, first of all, yes, the more you revise the global structure, if you just write it out straight away, versus if you changed it, the more you change it, then you do feel as if you understand things better. So that's beneficial, and that's deliberate problem solving. And that's one aspect of clarifying your understanding. So it's an important aspect, it's something which helps produce good quality text, it helps the writers also, subjectively, feel they've developed their understanding. But this other process of sentence production is exactly the opposite. The more spontaneously people wrote, and the less they'd outlined before, the more they felt they'd discovered things. And we've seen that conflicts with quality. So an important aspect of how the writer feels they can develop their thoughts, this spontaneous way of writing, and it doesn't help the quality of their writing if anything disrupts it. Okay. I'll just tell you that in a bit more detail. So this is a graph of that relationship. We like this. You go here and sort of, wow, this really, we've got proof of this, or evidence. So along here, it shows how spontaneous or controlled your sentence production. So at this end, these people, they are the ones who long pauses, clean text production. At this end, you've got people who write short pauses and more messy text. Along the left-hand side, it shows how much their ratings change. So this is zero. So after writing, they say, I don't feel I know any more than before I do. Negative, slightly less. And then above here is people who increased it. And on the graph, we've got, first of all, this dark line represents the outline planning condition. Okay. So those are people who made outlines before they were reassigned them to that. They had to do it. And the main thing about that is actually they don't discover very much. It's sort of varied between minus 0.1 and plus 0.1, the majority of writers. So essentially, outline planning suppresses this sentence production. I mean, it's not surprising. That's what, to a certain extent, what an outline is designed to do, is at the start work out what you're going to say and then try and implement that quite deliberately. Okay? But doing that pushes down the extent to which people say they develop their understanding. I'll come back to that in a bit. This dotted line represents when they've beforehand, they don't organise the text, they just get their main idea and then write it out, and they've got to do any organisation during writing. That's the key place where developing their understanding happens. They write spontaneously and they've not made a plan beforehand, and that virtually 70% of the people will experience an increase in their knowledge. Okay, so that's on average is 0.7 of an increase in a 5-point rating scale. That's suppressed the more, as the wrong line goes down, the more they control how they produce their sentences. So if they take a long pause, etc., then it goes down to virtually zero. Okay. So the main thing here is that you need two things for this. This spontaneous form of text production here is either associated with no knowledge development when you've got an outline, or when you haven't done that and you've kind of constituted it in the course of producing it, a really strong increase in understanding. So we think this represents, was when you made an outline, what's happening, the reason you get brief pauses and just write it out, is that you've got in your head my outline of what to do, and you just say, okay, next idea. Okay. In this one, you're saying, okay, next idea, but you're having to generate in response to that, based on your implicit understanding, what the next idea is. So we think that corresponds to what the theory claims is this knowledge constituting process. And one thing in future research is to try and understand which parts of the brain that's related to and so forth. That's a key signature of that, and this is a strong relationship. Okay, so this is another thing. This shows the relationship between how good your text is along here, so high quality and low quality, that's a single dimension, but these are plotted at the extremes. And along here, how much you change your understanding. Okay, so how much you discover. And here is the outline condition. I'll talk about that first, and this is the other condition. So when you've made an outline before writing, according to, again, to the problem-solving model, changing your discovery is in the purposes of trying to produce higher quality text. Take your audience into account and say, oh, a better way of doing that to make them understand is say this, which I hadn't thought of. So those should be the same. In fact, high text quality, when you make an outline, that's zero, is best when you haven't discovered anything. You know exactly what you feel you know, exactly what you felt before. Even, and this is the dotted line, represents people who've revised the text a lot. Even when you do that, you might revise it, but it's kind of cosmetic. It's changing how you present it, but not about changing your understanding. So for an outline planning condition, if you want to have high quality text, you don't want to discover it. Okay? You want to organize it, put it down, and so forth. By contrast, if you do discover something, so this is the case where people have revised their text a lot, the top 20% is actually on that one. And you can see here, the more that people increase their understanding, the worse the quality of their text. So if you just think of that, when they're writing, they're in kind of, oh, and they go this, that, and the other, but it's all getting quite convoluted as they try and work it out, and they really disrupt the text. So it's a problem, particularly with outline language, in that it looks like, you know, there's something that for personally, to capture your understanding, you want to do. If you do that, it will disrupt the quality of the text. Okay? And actually, the ideal is, when you make an outline, is get everything sorted beforehand, and then just essentially write it out. Okay? Which is good quality text, and that's what the results show, but it is preventing this capturing of your own personal understanding through writing. Looking at turning out of the synthetic planning where they don't make an outline, and the main thing to notice is first of all that levels of increased understanding are slightly higher, those lines are slightly higher than these, so that happens a bit more in this condition. But particularly, these people who revise the structure globally, that's in completely the opposite direction to here. Okay. So now, high text quality is associated with people who revise the text a lot as they're going along, but they're also increasing their understanding. So that simple switch between the kind of plan and the same amount of time, whether you make an outline or not, has reversed that relation. Now, you haven't been able to plan before, so the kind of revisions you make as you go along are required in order to make sure any changes you've made, or new thoughts you've got, are integrated into a coherent text. And because you haven't prepared that ahead of time, you can let build that into the text as you write it. So it suggests that synthetic planning, you can reconcile this kind of discovery with also high-quality text. One of the things about that is in our experiment, we only gave them a time to write a single draft. So given that this revision is required to introduce good quality text, people who don't revise much here, although they produce good quality text, they don't develop their understanding, and they also don't produce good quality text, is that if you gave them time after they wrote, then they'd be able to do that revision, any messiness in the initial draft, they could then correct. And particularly given the reducing sentences to develop your understanding disrupts quality, you should be able to revise that afterwards. Okay. So these are compatible with and suggest that might be one way of resolving this conflict. So these results suggest, yes, like previous researchers suggested, outlining does help you with quality, okay? But it does that at the expense of you developing your understanding. So if you're not worried about that, don't think that matters, that's fine. You'll produce a good text for people assessing you, etc., and so forth. But you won't feel, oh, it's really captured something about my understanding. The alternative suggests that, yes, you can, if you write more spontaneously, you can capture that understanding, but possibly at the expense decent quality. And it may be that some writers, when they're really important, they're really engaged with the topic, actually, they get carried away with all the convolutions of that they can't explain it properly. But we would suspect from these results that one way of doing that would be to have the organisation and stuff being after the fact rather than before. So you don't want to do the outlining because that suppresses it. You need to allow it to be messy, but then revise it. So, kind of summary of so far is that we've got two different kinds of processes, and we think that experiment that I've just described demonstrates there are two different things going on. So, regardless of how you interpret keystrokes, and they are notoriously quite difficult, you know, just to tell from patterns of those exactly what they mean, the fact they're different suggests, well, there's something different going on. So we think this, first of all, there is something about you trying to, and it's a really important part of writing, and it's what a lot of teaching focuses on, is understand your audience, understand the text structure, the genre you're writing, and a lot of teaching will explain that. I, as a psychologist, I teach research methods, and part of my job is teaching people how to write a journal article or a lab report, what the different segments of a paper are, what the structures are, and that takes people a long time to learn. Okay. So a part of that is a really important thing, explaining what the purposes are in writing. But there's also this implicit personal understanding, which is something which is constituted in the course of writing the test, if you write it in a certain way. And these results suggest that this happens more when you set a purpose for the writer, but then you let it unfold as to how it does. And that conflicts with this other thing. One of the my experience of writing is one of the tensions for me is, yes, part of it is, oh my God, there's so many things to think of. But the other thing is, oh, I was planning to do this, but it doesn't work. And this, I was really stuck with this. And very often I have to force myself to say, okay, just this bit, just kind of explore it and discuss it with myself. So I have to say, I'm not trying to produce. And very often I'm like, oh, actually, the thing I was trying to make, one point, there's actually 2 points, and this qualifies that and really goes on to the other thing. Okay? But that is a tension within writing. And I think also one of the reasons why we procrastinate so much is because, and I make plans eternally, because if you plan, you're, wow, this is going to be great. And then you sit down and try and write it. Whereas actually, you know, the other thing is when you start going, you know, oh, this is quite interesting. Yeah. So I do think this captures something, an intrinsic conflict in writing. And that tends to be talked about in terms of, oh, I've just had too much to think about. And there's an element to that. But I think it is these two conflicting tensions. And part of the other thing is, this implicit personal understanding, is you've got kind of you and what you haven't yet said, and kind of you feel you want to say, and then you've got these external requirements of how you should be speaking, and that's quite a personal self-exposure as well. So I'm sort of kind of moving on to speculate about how this maps onto our experience of writing, and I think these correspond roughly with that, but one of the things with our research is to try and really pin those down. So, secondly, outlining, and again, this is as you'd expect, it does, there's good evidence that outlining compared to not outlining does help, okay? But it seems to disrupt discovery, and we suggest a reverse outlining. So I'll just say a few things about reverse outlining. We did some experiments where one of the things with the classic experiments is they used to compare, you make an outline, and then you write the text. And they compared that with one where people had to write everything at the same time, and they showed that, yeah, when you divide them up into two separate phases, it's more economical, you can focus on one thing than the other, and write better. They also did some revision studies, where they got people to write a rough draft and then revise it. But their instructions for the rough draft were, you can just, don't worry about what the language is, you can correct the language after. We would say you have to not worry about how the organisation is, and maybe still doing that. So we don't think they compared the right thing. So myself and Mark Torrance, a long time ago, we asked people to write in two phases, phase one, phase two, 20 minutes, a 5-minute break to read over what they'd written, and then rewrite in the second phase. And we varied what they did in the first. In the planning condition, explicitly said, make notes beforehand, and we had a variable, they were structured or not, and then write the text afterwards. In the revising condition, we've made them write a rough draft, extract the structure out, and then write the second. Okay. And so that's the basic manipulation. And then we added in that between these two phases, you could either see what you've done in the first stage, or you do it all, and that was taken away, and you then wrote the second. So, Justine Ong and a colleague did this study with an equivalent study to ours with second language, or writing a second language, and essentially similar condition. So she had people writing the two phases. So if you look at the white bars, this is two phases. People planning for a relatively brief amount of time, a more extended amount of time. So that's the planning condition. First draft, they made a plan, and and then they produced the text. And she had a free writing edition, which is equivalent to our rough draft, where people wrote freely and then revised it. And then she had a control condition where people wrote their normal strategy, broken into two phases. So for the white bars, this shows when they could see what they'd done in the first phase. They could use the first phase notes. Okay? And what's focusing on these white bars, you can see as you do more, relatively more planning, quality goes up. Making a rough draft and then trying to revise it, dreadful. Okay? So that's against what we think. And the control condition, which is, that's not significantly different. Most people, they do plan, and they found in their control, which this do what you normally do, and when they've been instructed to plan, they get about the same quality. It's just the white bars. And rough drafting, which is slightly different to our version of rough drafting, but it is a rough drafting condition, was worst of anything. So that supports the traditional research. The black bars represent the situation where they're doing exactly the same things, but when they've finished the first one, you take it away and they can't look at it. Okay. So you get essentially similar findings here and here. Okay. This one, bing, it goes up. So when you write a rough draft, if you take away that first draft, say, okay, you've done that, and according to us, you will have developed your understanding, but we're saying, don't worry about all that, now write it out fresh, that produces really good quality. As good as anything else. And notice that people in a normal strategy, if you do that, you take away what their initial thing is, the quality goes down. Okay. So normally people like to be able to see that, it goes against their instincts. Okay. But when you do that, that seems to, and that is exactly the reason I presented this, she's got a nice figure. Dangerous territory. I have no idea, I've never met her. These are exactly the same as what we found. So, you know, things aren't right enough, but this marked contrast was if you wrote a rough draft exploring your thought and kept it, then it's as if you find it really difficult to change this messy thing. Okay? You've got time to do it. If you take it away, when you've got to write it out again, you do just as well as if you'd made an outline before. So that's kind of as a new finding compared to what other people have done. And we would say it is important to form the basis for writing a rough draft. There have been some studies, Marlene Kieft taught this in secondary schools, outlining versus revising strategy, and she did find a kind of revising strategy worked for secondary school students. To take this from an experimental context, a slightly artificial thing, we've done a questionnaire study, and that's actually what Sophie's questionnaire study about, which I put the link for. We want to see how people with dyslexia, how they map onto this. This extracted from about 40 questions two underlying dimensions which fit with previous theory. One is how much people see writing as a matter of developing their ideas while they write and revising as being a thing that you should revise a lot over a series of drafts. Okay, so this is self-report about how you ought to write. And people with high are people who develop their ideas a lot, or think writing involves developing ideas, and revise a lot, people who are low don't. So that's one dimension. Okay? Separate dimension is these two lines, and high TM plan, sorry I couldn't change this bit, consists of people who believe writing is about transmitting ideas you already know and making a detailed outline which you write. Okay? That's separate to whether you think it's also that, so two independent dimensions. So high TM plan are planners, if you like, self-report. Low TM plan, I think, no, it's not really about transmitting ideas, and I don't believe you should make detailed outlines. So what we find is that for undergraduates, this is self-reports and their grades of coursework writing, is essentially that slight upward pressure, the more people believe it's about developing your ideas, etc. But this only happens, you only get really high quality, when you've got high transactional revising, you believe that developing your ideas and revising them a lot is important, and less planning ahead of time. You don't think it's about transfer. So that's self-report, but it looks like it corresponds with what we find in the experiments. Okay? And this is undergraduates self-reporting about their grades, which is a bit of a worry, they might be lying, but why it should fall into this pattern, I don't know. And this, oh, this hasn't come out yet. This corresponds, these are standardized, because there were 400 students in this, and some of them were Dutch, and some of them were English, and the Dutch have a different grading system. How they could possibly do this, but they do. So this is equivalent to a high 2-1. All of these are relatively elite universities, and that's kind of the mark that people want to do that. And that this difference goes up, so that's kind of 68 in our scale. And it goes up possibly to a first, the highest. So it's about a 3 or 4% difference in COBUS merits. And it looks like people who use something which might be, when we do proper research or on this, like a reverse algorithm. So we think that overall strategy consists of collecting ideas and notes before, so it's not completely off the top of your head, okay? In our condition, they did have 10 minutes to generate their ideas in the experiment, then they had to form into an outline and do that. So we're not saying, you don't read, think about as much as you do. It's just when you come to the moment of writing, rather than trying to make a detail like that, you say, okay, what's the basic story I want to tell? And you write a draft then, trying to explain that, following how your path unfolds. And then you rewrite that over a series of drafts. And we think that's what they would correspond to. And one piece of research we want to do is actually teach students how to do that, according to what we found, which we had no idea that some of those are artificial, and see whether it works, and then tell them how which bits are easy and so forth, and compare that with other strategies. So, at last, I'm going to work talk a bit about writers, undergraduates with dyslexia. So we wanted to know how does, just collect some experimental evidence about people with dyslexia and people without dyslexia, writing an essay under timed conditions, which we already knew would handicap. Okay, so we already know from Vince Connolly's work that typically undergraduate students do produce, under similar time constraints, do tend to produce poorer qualities. Why? Students are given extra time, and we'll see as good motivation for that. So that was an experimental study. One of the things that he found it was mostly to do with the quality of the sentences and the spelling, you know. And it didn't really seem to impact the overall best ratings of overall organisation. The theory would actually suggest that if you're really having to worry too much about how to work out, you're spending all your time thinking about quite low-level features, spelling and transcription, then you've got less left over for thinking about how to organise this. Would expect this to disrupt high-level processes. So we were particularly interested in that. So we had 60 undergraduates, with and without dyslexia, so that's half and half. And we gave them intelligence tests and dyslexia assessment tests with things like spoonerisms, nonsense word reading, spelling tests, and so forth. And there's a clear difference in that. No difference in intelligence in our sample, spatial, verbal, but huge differences on what we call the phonological spelling things. That was all one factor. It kind of just supports our categories we put them into. But we had a measure of how much they varied in those terms. Then we asked them to make an outline before they wrote essays. And while they were doing it, I know in this case it was about discussing the pros and cons of the euthanasia rate tube. While they were doing that, we interrupted them with beeps periodically throughout the half an hour they're writing. And when the beep sounded, we'd given them, they'd had classify what they were doing. Were they thinking of an idea? Were they busy writing out words, etc.? And that enabled us to sort of track a bit of their processes while they're writing. That was only half. We had people doing that with them and that, because we wanted to test, is this natural? Do you think this might disrupt you? Actually, it doesn't. And it didn't disrupt the dyslexic. People with dyslexia more than the ones without or have any relationships with the quality. So it reduced the size of the sample. And we had input on recording keystrokes as we went along. So what we found was writers with dyslexia made more spelling mistakes, twice as many, about 60%, and they wrote shorter texts. They had half an inch of letters. Not very surprising. But sort of nice to know you proved the obvious, because if you hadn't, you think, oh, what have we done? And then even after we'd corrected the spelling and capitalization and things like that, and punctuated them as best we could, they were still rated as much lower quality. So they're writing under the same kind of time constraints, and it was a 9-point scale, so it was about 2 points lower. So it was a big effect. Okay? So none of this is particularly surprising. Okay? That suggests you really, it's really important that people with dyslexia do have extra time. And triple time, doing this secondary task of classifying, pressing a button, didn't seem to make much difference. So this represents here's the quality of their text, and here's whether you have dyslexia or not, and here's your verbal ability. And this represents a plot of the relationships between. So if you have dyslexia, then your phonological processing, spelling ability is low. Strong negative relationship. So dyslexia affects that. If you've got spelling is harder for you, and phonology is not very good, you will pause for longer between four words. That's one of the reasons why it's slower. Every word you're taking much longer. And when you look at keystroke things, you can see a perfectly produced text, and you look at the keystroke underlying it, and you see someone's taking 2 minutes because they're worrying about how to spell a word. But that's completely hidden. People just say, oh, they haven't written much. So that kind of maps that, and it shows it does affect the quality of what you do. So that fact, the longer doing that, is really reducing quality. So giving extra time should help with that, and helping with spelling should help. The other factor with that is verbal ability, verbal intelligence, that also the higher your verbal ability, the shorter the pause before words. You can fluently get words, and therefore the better quality text. So that's independent. So these two things add together to influence this effect of quality. Okay. So that suggests, yes, there is a route whereby the phonological and spelling ability is related to poorer quality text. But there is still pathway unaccounted for by that, significant to text quality. So verbal ability, whether you're dyslexic or not, affects how you do. But there's something else that's going on. It might be just it's something else we haven't measured, but it doesn't look like it's just this simply this thing of how well you can manage quality. The triple task told us a little bit about what this might be. We can't put this in the diagram because only half the people actually did this. So this is fine. This shows how much they reported during the writing, when the beeps go off, and thinking of an idea. Okay, so I'll just press that button. And these are people who did it a lot. The numbers are, this is one standard deviation above and one below. That's a continuous scale, so this is more or less. These are just high, and these are low. And here is how good the quality of the text is, by our judgments, two judgments. This blue line represents people without dyslexia. Okay? And as you'd expect from the outline in rationale, and they've all made an outline before they wrote, people who were still, while they wrote, thinking of content, this is not doing that, so here is highlights. People who were thinking of content while they wrote had relatively low quality text. The more they weren't doing that during writing, i.e. they'd done it all before when they made their outline, and now they're just translating it, the better the quality of text. That fits perfectly with the rationale for an outline. You don't want to be trying to think of all your ideas while you're trying to write the text. You want to get that straight in your outline, and then not think about that, focus on, here they would be saying, we would just think about it. For people without dyslexia, that's exactly what he finds. And you know, there's good evidence for it. People with dyslexia, it's exactly the other way around. The people who got worst marks, you know, really big difference, 6 points on a 9-point scale and nearly three, were the ones precisely who weren't thinking of content while they were writing. Okay? And as the more progressively they thought of ideas while they wrote, notice these are still the same level, but up to the same level as their quality went up. So it's very different. And so traditionally, we think of outlining as being something that should help people with dyslexia. The fact that this is different doesn't mean it won't, but it does suggest there's some issue with coordinating your outline. And that could be a number of things. The other thing which they reported is we asked them, we also had them, they could look at their plans, but we asked them to turn it over. So every time they wanted to look at their plan, they had to do that in every video. And we told them. And so we could see when they consulted their plans. People with dyslexia tended to do that at more idiosyncratic times. So this typical one is you can do a paragraph where it could not be able to do revision, and they would go and look at the plan just to check. Quite often this can happen within a sentence for dyslexics. This wasn't very, they didn't do that very much, it's quite low numbers, but that was another deal. So our conclusion is, okay, you get slower formulation of text because of your problems with spelling, not spelling. That's a good reason, you know, good support for why you should have more time. But there is a suggestion that the thing that we might, and we, Sophie did some interviews with students prior to her research, and quite a few of them swore, I could not write without that. So, you know, we don't know that that's necessarily a good thing. We're not recommending it. We want to explore it. But that there is something problematic about that. And there are three possibilities. One is that if you're generating what you're thinking and then writing it down, the content is driving the syntax. And I think that you notice with any writers, people will write all sorts of ungrammatical stuff. They never say that. Okay? And it's partly because you've got this time to think about it. So one of the benefits, perhaps, of generating content as you're writing is that's kind of driving your sentences and making them more natural. That's one possibility, that it's something to do with generating ideas affecting the sentence production. The alternative is that it's the other way around. That actually, if you're struggling with spelling, etc., you're going to forget what plans. You need to reconstruct your ideas and do that planning. So that although you've made an outline, you need to reconstruct that there because it's been disrupted by that. And that would fit perfectly with the problem solving model. So it could be an alternative explanation. And we don't know which of those. And the final question is, given this issue that how effective, and I have no idea about your ideas about this, can you imagine someone with dyslexia writing a rough draft and then revising it? We did kind of ask, and we tended to get shrugs of the shoulders, I think we'd say, you know, not writing with grass, just by the way, at last someone's got the way I write. So, but we've only interviewed a few people. So, I don't know how effective that could be, particularly, you know, you have to read your own text to do that, and how disruptive that is. So one of the things that Sophie will be doing in her research is doing that experiment we've done with keystrokes with a sample of, we're hoping 60 people with dyslexia and 60 without. So again, any help you can give us in recruiting undergraduates who might like to participate would be fabulous. And particularly the survey that you do from anywhere. because that should tell us a bit about this. Yes, so that's my story and the story so far. Hopefully, maybe in a few years' time, when Sophie's finished her PhD, she'll be able to continue all about what we found and whether, forget what we said before, it's this, or